Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Greetings. This is Abba Yomi Azikiwe, and welcome to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abba Yomi Azikiwe. Today is Sunday, March 28th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to another edition of our program. Later on, we'll be coming up with our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the exploration for oil and natural gas resources taking place in Zimbabwe, where President Emmerson Mnangagwa says the findings are strategic. The Republic of Sudan has signed agreements with rebel groups, which have been at war for years with the central government. Russia has offered to assist Egypt in dislodging a megaship now blocking the Suez Canal. And South African Minister of Education, Blade Nzimande, has spoken out about the property destruction carried out recently at several universities. In the second hour, we rebroadcast a recent episode of Global Research News Hour, which included an interview with host Abba Yomi Azikiwe discussing the 10th anniversary of the Pentagon-NATO war against Libya. And we continue our month-long focus on Women's History Month with a segment on the intellectual history of black women. And these and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take a musical interlude. We'll be back later with more of our program for this week.
Mama. mbengo ngai na retana mibali bali ngaka ngai mibali ya matoe utangana bana vi na bo mwana e ngai nonga na zuwa mobali ya nga mokote o confiance, au kanisa ki na zalizo bana zala ki se koye bise, mokole zalina poboya yo. Na la ki sa ki o fidelite, au kanisa ki ngana tula, lelo yonga yo yo na balie, dodo na segi o bosa nanga, dodo papa, ah, motema mo zalima koe, na pesa na pede jete. Wapi mwaenga na trompe ye. Oh, tika korebete ye. Inafote na munuve. Kanga mote mabosana. Eza liberore ya la vi.
Dodo, patience, na fidélité na zalagi na wepe na yo. Yo mokonde o baby saki. Tala siko komi konya kon kwanga na simandako. Ok na zaki mwasi, na kati andako na yo. O moni berer dodo. Koza koye langa soi disant moana. Ah. Comme un PDG, na boy mindondo. Oyo bala au vent nette. Sia. Akoma dongoromiso boni. Ha.
Na la disa ya tampala ta e bolingo fili makambo eleki na femisa ta mokenzo toe. No kina kufa pona yo.
Dodo, moi c'est Azalaka Zobate, moi c'est Akanisaka, toi et Bigazé Mama, t'as la sigo comme go regrette, Nazonga Zouzima, Nazina Madi Escalier, Dodo, Bosanangai, Dengo Bosana Chaussette Nayo, Yakala, Dodo. Vraiment, au Pessinga numéro, y a pas la peine à son vanda casse Flora. Katina Salaboni, Lokola na lingio, Sala noki noki ngai na yo, tokutanae. Salangai plaisir, tokutana to solo la, nakanisi onko regrette mon kete o flora.
Naye mi maloba ya mi bali ya mi koloyo, pasi po nanga na zali, okipe diye.
Flora na lingina pesa yo li kolona po mengo nanse, banani bazali, to senginya yo flora.
Na moke azoka na moke apesa kangai, wana emoki nangai, po di.
Esto koki kola kisangai, mon pali na yo, natala sokia kokani, nangai flora.
Eske ope o koki kola kisanga mwasi na yo, natala soki ngai nalekie, naningie.
Talandenge borataka ba chanson na mokili ya nzawe, nzawe atindi ngai na yo, tolinga nae.
Ngai pe nzawe, motatinda nga libala.
Koloko kufa, nzawe akotuna yo, mobali na tindaki, oboyaki ye tina.
Yope mo koloko kufa, nzawe akotuna yo, osalaki koloko mwase ya moninga, osina ye.
Flora oko singai vremo, ope singa nimero, ya balabala pena zono vandaka te flora.
Na bangaki, ope sa yo adres, mobali na nzana sanga tata o mingie.
Kasina salaboni, lokola na lulio, sala noki noki ngai na yo, tokutana.
Na boi na nga osali na mwasi na yo, na ipe na zali, na mobali na ngai diye.
Sala ngai plaisir, tokutana to solola, na kianisi oko regrete mokete o flora.
Na ye mi maloba ya mi bali ya mi kolo oyo, kasi po na nga na zali, okipe.
Nalingina pesa yo likolo na bomengo na nse banani bazali kokosa yo flora.
Na moke azwaka na moke apesaka ngai wana ekoki na ngai odie.
Esto koki kolakisa ngai mopali na yo natala soki akokani na ngai flora.
Eske ope okoki kolakisa ngai mwasi na yo.
Alandenge borataka ba chance na mokili ya nzawe, nzawe atindi ngai na yo, tolinga nae.
Ngai pe nzawe, motatinda nga libala, avoy na kosa mobali na ngai, odie.
Mokolo kokufa, nzawe akotuna yo, mobali na tindaki, oboyaki ye tinae.
Yo pe mokolo kokufa, nzawe akotuna yo, osalaki koluka mwasi ya moninga.
Lokola to ebani te o to zala kamarade.
Lokola ba ebani te o to zala kamarade.
Lokola to ebani te o to zala ba kamarade.
Lokola to ebani te o to zala kamarade.
Mama lokola to ebani te o to zala ngobande konza.
Lokola to ebani te o to zala kamarade.
Lokola to ebani te o to zala ba kamarade.
Lokola ba ebani te o to zala kamarade.
Lokola to mugani te o to zala mobande koma.
Lokola to mobani te o to zala kamarade.
Lokola to ebani te o to zala mobande koye.
Lokola to ebani te o to zala kamarade.
eseliseo tozala ngobandeko mama
lokola bayebani teo tozala kamarade
lokola toyebani teo tozala ngobandeko mama
lokola tolobani teo tozala kamarade
Ça 6 millions.
Et ça fait. L'encaisseur.
Moi je n'encaisse pas. Mais Baniel et Nana, décision. kombwaka mokuwa teo
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast, a special edition of our program for Sunday, March the 28th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit, and that was the music of the TPOK Jazz Orchestra, led by the legendary Francois Makati, better known as Francois. That album featured vocalists Daniel and Nana from 1987. Right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. Our lead story deals with the situation in the southern African state of Zimbabwe. The ZANU-PF-led government has made considerable progress in delivering on developmental projects and other election promises are outlined in this manifesto, despite disruptions caused by the coronavirus pandemic. That's according to President Mnangagwa. This is according to an article that was published earlier today in the Zimbabwe Sunday Mail, written by Harmony Aguirre. The article goes on to say that in his keynote address to the first session of the 115th ZANU-PF Central Committee in Harare on yesterday, the president said one of the notable achievements is the signing of the $30 million U.S. Oil and gas exploration deal, which will see the country become the fifth largest oil producer in the world if deposits in Muzarabani, Mashonaland Central, prove to be commercially exploitable. Two oil and gas wells will be drilled by October this year, while production might start as early as March of 2022. The Second Republic is on a permanent and irreversible path of modernizing, industrializing, and growing our economy, the president said. He went on to note that yesterday I witnessed the signing ceremony of a $30 million oil and gas exploration agreement between my government, Geo Associates, a private limited company, and Invictus Energy, an Australian stock exchange listed company. This strategic project has far-reaching positive prospects to transform the livelihood of the people of Muzarabani district in particular and boost the gross domestic product, the GDP, of Mashonaland Central Province. He said investors are confident they will find oil in the area. If that happens, according to estimates, Zimbabwe will be the fifth largest oil producer, and that is a unique situation. Agriculture, he added, was poised to register gains anchored by a bumper harvest, while the presidential horticultural program is reportedly taking root in Zimbabwe. The recent launch of community-based export-led garlic production in our country has exciting prospects, according to the president. He also talked about the rollout of the national COVID-19 vaccination program by the Zimbabwe government. The president said it will continue until everyone is safe from the disease. He said that earlier this last week, I launched the second phase of national COVID-19 vaccination program in Victoria Falls. This second phase will now include teachers, security service sector, the judiciary, the elderly, and people with chronic conditions. The third phase will be later rolled out for the rest of the society until we achieve herd immunity. We can only be safe when everyone is safe from COVID-19. The president urged the Central Committee of the ruling party, ZANU-PF, which is the party's highest decision-making organ, to remain true to the expectations of forebears who left them the sacred responsibility to economically empower the people. And in other news in Zimbabwe, the First Lady, Auxilia Mnangagwa, has generated interest among academics and cultural experts in regard to some programs which she has been advocating. They are tailored to tackle social problems impacting youth and also to impart knowledge of cultural and traditional value systems.
Amai in Mongagua yesterday took her ongoing program to Makonde in Mashonaland West Province. Speaking on the sidelines of the program at the Kori Kori Cultural Village, Professor Makias Masiyiwe, a lecturer in the Department of History, Heritage, and Knowledge Systems at the University of Zimbabwe, said it was praiseworthy that the First Lady was using her position to influence positive change in communities. She said, "I teach indigenous knowledge systems, issues that have to do with culture and arts. We are at the Kori Kori Cultural Village in view of Amai's program, in which she is trying to promote the resuscitation of our African cultural values so that they are understood by young generations that are getting lost," the professor said. For the First Lady to conduct her program at the village, he added, "It indicates to children the importance of local cultural values." And in other news taking place around the African continent, in Sudan, the government signed an agreement with a rebel faction earlier today to guide future peace negotiations as the country's transitional leaders move to put an end to a myriad of internal conflicts. The Declaration of Principles signed with the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, the SPLMN, faction lays out priorities including the unification of armed forces and the establishment of a democratic secular with a religion, freedom of religious state. It was signed by Sudanese head of state General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Abdel Aziz al-Hulu, head of the SPLMN faction. The group is based in the states of South Kordofan and Blue Nile in the country's south. The signing took place in South Sudan's capital of Juba. The next thing is the two parties will resume talks 3 weeks from now. That's according to a mediation team official, Ramadan Gauche. He told this to the Agence France-Presse. They are now going to organize their teams and prepare to resume the talks, he said. The transitional government in Khartoum, which includes soldiers and civilians installed after the 2019 overthrow of Omar al-Bashir's 30-year dictatorship, have made peace with the country's rebel groups a priority. A historic agreement was signed in October with the Sudan Revolutionary Front, an alliance of rebel groups from the Darfur, Blue Nile, and South Kordofan regions. A branch of the Sudan Liberation Movement led by Abdel Wahid Nour in Darfur refused to sign the document. Hulu's SPLM North signed a separate ceasefire, allowing its fighters to keep their weapons for self-protection until the Sudanese constitution is amended to guarantee separation of state and religion. South Kordofan and, to a lesser extent, Blue Nile state have significant Christian populations who have fought for decades to end the imposition of Islamic law by Khartoum. And you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in other developments taking place on the African continent in regard to the situation in South Africa, Higher Education Minister Bladen Zamandi had called for the university chancellors to tighten security measures at higher educational institutions. He went on to say that the minister has condemned recent incidents of vandalism at institutions across the country during the recent student protests, as well as acts of criminality. In Zamandi, that at least 10 institutions, including the University of Johannesburg and the University of KwaZulu-Natal, were vandalized while some buildings were torched, with the damages costing more than 32 million rand. The minister said none of the acts of violence by students could be justified. His spokesperson, Ishmael Mnizi, said that ministers call on all local law enforcement agencies to act swiftly against any acts of violence and the destruction of public and private property. The minister further calls on all university chancellors to tighten up appropriate safety and security measures to prevent any form of destruction. Also, Russia's ambassador to Egypt said earlier today that his country would offer the country any possible assistance as efforts continue to free a megaship that has been blocking the Suez Canal for nearly a week. The MV Ever given has been struck diagonally across the span of the canal since Tuesday, blocking the waterway in both directions. In comments to the state-run WIA Novosti news agency, Russian Ambassador Gorgy Borisenko said that Moscow is ready to help in any way it can. We hope that this problem will be overcome in the very near future, that the work of the channel will be restored, and naturally we are ready to provide our Egyptian friends with any possible assistance from our side, according to the ambassador. Borisenko adds that Egypt has not reached out to Moscow for support, but said Russia emphasizes and empathizes with what's happening now in the Suez Canal and the importance of the canal to the world's waterway. On Saturday, Suez Canal Authority Chief Osama Rabi had told reporters that the massive ship could be afloat by Sunday night. The jam has crippled international trade and forced companies to reconsider rerouting vessels around Africa's Cape of Good Hope, a longer and more expensive way to travel between Asia and Europe. Another Russian ambassador had earlier this week seized on the Suez Canal blockage to promote Russia's northern shipping route as a reliable alternative, part of a broader push by Moscow to develop the Arctic and capitalize on climate change. And finally, in the Republic of Mozambique, dozens are still unaccounted for in the country after Islamist attacks in the northern province of Cabo Delgado. The family of a South African man who was missing in the war-torn town of Palma in Mozambique has thanked the nation for their support. Francois von Niekerk, who is 21 years old, was rescued earlier today after hiding in bushes from Islamic insurgents along with other foreign nationals for several days. Rebels seized control of the town after French oil and gas giant Total announced it would be resuming its $20 billion project in the area. About 200 expatriates took refuge inside of a Amarula Palma Hotel after the town came under siege on Wednesday. The group were ambushed at the gates of the hotel as they tried to flee in a vehicle convoy after waiting to be evacuated. It is still unclear how many South Africans were among the foreigners and locals who were killed in the 4 days of fighting in Mozambique's coastal town of Palma. But now South Africa has said it is working with the authorities in Mozambique to offer support and consular services to those who managed to flee. One of the South Africans who died during the attack was Adrian Nell. It's understood the KwaZulu-Natal resident was shot during an ambush on Friday. Meanwhile, Sonia von Niekerk, the mother of Francois who escaped, says she's happy that her son did not suffer the same fate. Niekerk has thanked South Africans for their support. At the same time, both the Mozambican Embassy and the Department of International Relations and Corporations have not said how many South Africans are still unaccounted for inside the country. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. We want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in numerous newspapers, various magazines, journals, research reports, and on various blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, a special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, March the 28th, 2021. Just go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal.
That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. Not only can you have access to today's program for March 28, 2021, but over 1,000 other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal. The programs can be shared with other potential listeners by merely copying and pasting the links into emails and sending those emails out to other potential listeners. The programs can also be shared through social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. The links can be posted as well on blogs and websites. So we encourage all of our listeners to share the Pan-African Journal as well as the Pan-African Newswire. And this month is International Women's History Month, and we have been involved in presenting numerous programs and segments of programs related to the history and the social development and contributions of women to world history. And this is something that we not only do during the month of March, but we do it as well throughout the entire length and breadth of each. And this also holds true for the Pan-African Newswire media agency. Utilizes the same situation and the same emphasis on the total contributions of African people in not only the United States and the Western Hemisphere, but throughout the entire globe. So these are some of the developments that we have been following and will continue to follow in the weeks, months, and years to come. And there has been a lot of developments during the course of this month, this International Women's History Month. And, of course, there are many programs. There are many documentaries that air on various networks throughout the United States and indeed internationally. And, of course, here at the Pan-African Journal, we attempt to make our contribution by presenting both a historic as well as modern and contemporary audio files. A lot of those relate to historical figures, political figures. These historical and political figures, many of whom have been obscured by the actual official histories that have been made available to people in particularly in the Western Hemisphere. And of course, we have made that contribution by dealing with the search, the research, the editing, and the presentation of these important audio documents that under ordinary circumstances do not get a lot of exposure in regard to the general public here in the United States and indeed internationally. So that is one of the things that we've been working on here over the last year at the Pan-African Journal. And the Pan-African Journal is brought to you on a regular basis. Typically, on average, there are two programs per week, on average about eight programs per month. And we present news items, news analysis, historical audio files. And typically as well, we have what we consider to be themes centered around the programs. For example, during February, we typically have a focus on African American History Month.
during March, of course, we have a focus on the history of women and contemporary affairs of women. We look back on historical occurrences, for example, Dr. Martin Luther King Day in the United States, which is a federally recognized holiday. We present rare speeches and interviews about Dr. Martin Luther King during the month of January, and in many cases during the month of April as well, next month, which represents the anniversary of his martyrdom. So these are some of the objectives and some of the program emphases that we deal with here at the Pan-African Journal. And of course, we intend to continue our programming in that regard. And of course, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and we are here at the Pan-African Journal. And the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. And, of course, we're going to take a brief musical break, and we'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. And just stay tuned, and we shall be right back here at the Pan-African Journal. Welcome back, and that, of course, was George Michael and Aretha Franklin, Detroit's own Aretha Franklin, mega hit during the 1980s, and, of course, this comes on the heels of the genius Aretha depiction, representation last week, began a week ago on National Geographic. Right now, we're moving to our Women's History Month programming. This is Elizabeth Alexander, delivering a lecture on towards an intellectual history of Black women. Let's listen in.
Professor Alexander is chair of the Historic Department of African American Studies at her alma mater, Yale University. She received her MFA from Boston University and her PhD in English from the University of Pennsylvania. Many of you know her as the inaugural poet, she who delivered praise song for the day on that crisp, clear, historic January day in 2009. I'm sure many of you were there to hear it in person. Others of you were introduced to her through her first collection of poetry, The Venus Hottentot, first published in 1990. In between, she published several other collections, including Antebellum Dream Book, 2001, Body of Life, 1997, American Sublime, 2005, American Blue, Selected Poems, 2006, and most recently, Crave Radiance, New and Selected Poems, 1990 to 2010, published in 2010. All of these prove her to be an exquisite wordsmith, capable of creating quiet spaces for contemplation, spaces to focus on a detail, at first a simple detail that unfolds to reveal deep meaning and transformative possibilities. Her poems are steeped in history, but are also devoted to imagining futures. They give voice to those whom history has deemed mute, and these voices resonate long after we have closed the page. I can still hear Sartre Bartman talking back. As an essayist, Alexander brings keen analysis to bear upon subjects as diverse as Anna Julia Cooper, Romare Bearden, Rodney King. Her essay, Can You Be Black and Look at This?, reading the Rodney King video, is widely cited across a number of disciplines. It is bold, it is brave, it is profound. She has also published two collections of essays, Power and Possibility, Essays, Interviews, and Reviews in 2007, and the now classic, The Black Interior, 2003. She has received numerous awards, including the first Jackson Prize for Poetry awarded by poets and writers, two Pushcart Prizes, the George Kent Award given by Gwendolyn Brooks, as well as fellowships from both the Guggenheim and Alphonse Fletcher Foundation. After this list of accomplishments, we either are left inspired or tired, but usually both, and yet I think sometimes that my friend is tireless. In the midst of all of this, she manages to be a devoted and attentive mother to two boys, Solomon and Simon, and a teacher who shares her excitement over her students with friends and colleagues, and a friend who embodies the term sister friend. We heard today, earlier in today's panel, about women who were educators and poets. And tonight, I think we will hear from just such a woman, an educator and a poet. Brilliant, generous, radiant. Join me in welcoming Elizabeth Alexander.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Sister friends use phrases like the now classic. Sister friends call your children's name. Sister friends are always there. So I want to thank all of you for coming and to thank Martha Jones and Farah and Mia Bay and Barbara Savage who brought me here today, who invited me to present my work to you all. I can't imagine a better community for me to share this work, the beginnings of a project that I'm very excited about. To be in the midst of this conversation presenting this work is a privilege indeed. And I want to also say a special thank you to my sister scholars, many of whom are here, my real sister scholars, my girls, my fellow travelers for over 20 years now, who make me make sense to myself, who keep me going, and who are my ideal readers in the most extraordinary and perfect way. I'm also happy to have some representation from the department, some graduate students, some former teachers. Where did Marcellus go? Marcellus was my teacher. Yes, he was. So really, this couldn't be a better community. So I'm going to present to you today a portion from a book that I'm beginning that will be called A Prehistory of African American Studies. In the last couple years, and all of us have been a part of this, we've seen the commemorations of the 40th anniversary of African American Studies around the country as we've looked back at the beginning of the end of the elite American university and other institutions as homes largely for and governed by white, male, presumably heterosexual, prep school educated students. In thinking and talking about the 40th anniversary of African American Studies, in my capacity as chair of that department at Yale, I eventually wearied of my own recitation and those of others of a now familiar, though extremely important tale, the student activist, activist impetus for African American studies in the late 1960s and so forth. So a few months into the celebrations, I began to shift the course of my comments and emphasize the obvious but neglected, that what we were marking was the history of African American studies in program and department form at predominantly white universities, but that African American studies, the people, the contributions of people of African descent to fields as subject and episteme was in fact much, much older, reaching, of course, back to, I would think about the very late 19th century. I would think about the Atlanta University studies, the American Negro Academy, organized in March of 1897, texts later on, such as Sterling Brown's 1831 Outline for the Study of the Poetry of American Negroes, Woodson's Miseducation of the Negro, Benjamin Brawley's 1937 Aesthetic Manifesto, The Negro Genius, one of the unheralded greats, and other landmarks of African American studies before it was anywhere close to existing in mainstream universities. So the larger point, as we all know, is that African American studies is much older than 40 years. It has simply been taking place at historically black institutions and in historically black communities, places like Howard, like Fisk, like the Atlanta universities, like Washington, D.C.'s Dunbar High School, which was founded in 1870 as the M Street School, the first black public high school in the country, and educated at a time more notable black professionals and public servants than any high school in America, and where students were taught by some of the nation's first black PhDs who were not hired by colleges and universities. I became fascinated with how black studies scholars in the 20s, 30s, and 40s forged a discipline that we now call African American studies, and as it happens, the scholars whose work I have been examining are women. And that doesn't surprise any of you here that in a lot of the genealogies that we inherit, that the contributions of women are marginalized and put to the side in other kinds of ways. I'm exploring the ways that some of the disciplinary tenets of African American studies, though I don't wish to ossify those tenets, are found in the earlier work of these women. I call this project a prehistory as a way of reminding ourselves that disciplines are not eternal nor the same across institutions. Disciplines are living organisms subject to change. I thought that assembling a set of case studies of this early work with the purpose of imagining a new syllabus for the history of the discipline itself would help us predate our myth of origin decades back from the Annus Mirabilis of 1969. In the process, I've thought about how the interdisciplinarity we so vaunt today in African American studies as such a powerful toolkit for our students, in fact, has philosophical and practical origins in studies of the Negro in the 1920s and 30s. And so under the rubric, A Prehistory of African American Studies, today's talk proper is called Cemetery for the Illustrious Negro Dead. In 1931, three black women were engaged in advanced study in departments of anthropology in the United States. In 1931, Harcourt Brace published an anthology called Readings from Negro Authors for Schools and Colleges. This book was distinct from other Negro anthologies of the time, Johnson's Book of American Negro Poetry, Bontemps' Golden Slippers, Alain Locke's The New Negro, in that its mission was explicitly pedagogical and aimed not only at school-age students but also college students. As such, that book is a landmark in the university teaching of African American literature. It assumed a university audience. It assumed not only teachers but professors of African American literature in 1931. As such, then, it is another of our foremother texts in African American literary study, a book that defined a black canon as part of a larger project that would come to be called African American Studies. The editor's aim was integrative. Quote, the teacher of English has a wide range of choice, and for the specific program of American literature, the opportunity to embrace in true Catholicity of spirit writings that constitute a significant part of the total American output. The book was edited by Otelia Cromwell, who at the time was professor of English at Minor Teachers College, along with Lorenzo Dow Turner, who was professor of English at Fisk and who was known as the father of Gullah Studies and a key progenitor of African Studies. He developed that program at Fisk in the 1940s and was also the author of Africanisms in the Gullah Dialect, which he published in 1949 and is still an influential work today. And the third editor was Eva B. Dykes, who was associate professor of English at Howard University. The three held PhDs from Harvard, Radcliffe, and Yale, respectively. Dykes and Cromwell were the first and fifth black women in history to earn the PhD. Dykes in 1921 from Radcliffe. Radcliffe granted its first PhD in 1902, and it's a Radcliffe and not a Harvard PhD I was interested to discover. Dykes completed her requirements first, but Radcliffe graduation was held later in the spring, and so she received the degree a few days behind Sadie Marcel Tanner and Georgiana Simpson, University of Pennsylvania and University of Chicago. Dykes' dissertation was entitled, quote, Pope and His Influence in America, that is Alexander Pope, from 1715 to 1815, and explored the attitudes of Alexander Pope toward slavery and his influence on American writers. Cromwell's PhD was from Yale in the English department. Indeed, she was the first black woman that we know of to earn a degree from Yale. She has been memorialized by Smith College, where she was the first black female undergraduate graduate. And indeed, Smith College has an entire Otelia Cromwell Day, though I dare say Miss Cromwell would disdain the fact that on that day there are no classes. I am interested in Cromwell as part of the unarticulated history of black women at Yale, certainly, but also as unarticulated, and also as an important actor in this prehistory of African American studies. Cromwell studied at Yale between other engagements, which was commonplace for Negro scholars at the time. Everybody had a side job or jobs that could in themselves be considered full-time careers. These people had several careers going at the same time. So Cromwell was a teacher at the aforementioned Dunbar High School in Washington. She applied to take a leave from the high school and was discouraged to get her PhD and was discouraged by the local school board, who said she was acting in pointless self-interest. This is the same school board that tussled for years with Anna Julia Cooper. While at Yale, she studied, she left anyway, and she began her PhD studies, studying with professors George Nettleton, Robert Menner, and Tucker Brook. By her written account, he provided exceptional guidance. And in her foreword to her dissertation, she wrote that, quote, studying under Brook has been indeed a privilege and an inspiration. She also, in those acknowledgments, offers special thanks to Miss Margaret Corwin, identified as Executive Secretary of the Graduate School of Yale University. There isn't a lot on her in the alumni files of the university, but we do have her dissertation, Thomas Haywood, A Study in the Elizabethan Drama of Everyday Life. It was published by Yale University Press in the Yale Studies in English series in 1928. Combing her graduate file for any semblance of the woman is also a letter that she writes on October 5, 1922 to the Yale Athletic Association, requesting two tickets to the Harvard-Yale game. She says, quote, if I may have the privilege of buying tickets, will you send me an application blank? It is noted in her alumni records that she became a member of the board of directors of, quote, an Encyclopedia of the Negro, which was a project of Du Bois's. This is in 1932. From 1939 forward, her name is listed in a special card file labeled Negroes Who Attended Yale, though the graduate school tells you they don't keep records based on race, but they do have a card file called Negroes Who Attended Yale, which I found useful. And in other places on the record, she's identified as colored. The university has named prizes and scholarships and campus entryways for Edward P. Boucher, the first black male graduate of the university. Our own Department of African American Studies awards the William Pickens Prize, named after a fascinating polymath late graduate who came along a bit later, who, among other distinctions, was the first Negro awarded a certificate for the mastery of Esperanto. But Cromwell has never been identified or recognized by the university, nor was she known to the graduate school, nor has any other woman of color been recognized for her contribution to any aspect of the university's history. While studying in New Haven, Cromwell lived at 65 Edgewood Avenue, an address that will be familiar to some of you. A letter she wrote to her father on July 13, 1922, gave a wonderful description of graduate study, but also of a savvy scholar forging her way. 1922. "Well, I am back in New Haven, where at least the nights are cool even after hot days. I have a large room facing west with three windows. In the morning, I work in the Yale Library, which is a quiet, roomy place in the summertime. In the afternoons, I work in my own room. That is, at present, while I'm making a general survey of my subject, and it is possible to bring enough reading matter home from the library to occupy me for several hours. Later on, when my work becomes more detailed, involving a ceaseless verification of opinions from many sources, I shall be compelled, I think, to do all my reading in the library. Although I am not absolutely certain, I shall not know for sure until the department approves, I think I shall work on some phase of Elizabethan drama. From many points of view, it would be comfortable to select a subject relating to the Negroes, but two difficulties stood in the way. The improbability of my being able, from what I know of the possibilities of the field, to get something that would be big enough for the kind of book I've got to write, Haitian literature excepted, which would moreover fall into the French department. And more important, the fact that any work which I might do in that line would be absolutely independent, because, naturally, I'd know more about it than any of the folks here. In one way, the independent work would show a certain kind of power, but on the other hand, my main object being here is to learn scholarly method and to benefit by scholarly criticism. Most of all, I want the work I may do in the years to come, if years are granted to me, to be critically sound. This is my only opportunity for training, and training is needed for any output which is more than ephemeral or interesting to an unrestricted group of general readers. After this dissertation is done, but it may take 2 years to write it, some do, I shall be free and better trained to do something that will perhaps appeal more strongly to you, but I'm not sure and am promising nothing. Sufficient unto the day. There are some changes in the schools, nothing, however, which holds any attraction for me. Ambition for place or fame is not my besetting folly. Just to be on a public pinnacle, a visible target for all the shafts that the crowd will fling. I am glad that I have a sense of values which makes me happy in doing what I am doing, work that I like, which still leaves me time for study, time to keep unembittered, and perhaps to do this writing someday." Cromwell's first publication was her dissertation. But by 1931, just a few years later, 1928 to 1931, she's turned full-time to study of the Negro, that which would have proved impractical at Yale. English as a field has been supplanted with what I argue is a prehistory of what we now call African American studies. In the letter I've just read, Cromwell has neatly named the rub for some graduate students even today, attempting to find their way interdisciplinarily and in fields that would be built as they participated in them. Her 1931 anthology, with its explicitly pedagogical aims, draws a circle around a literature called African American, a literature which she centers and does not posit as substrata or at the margins. Cromwell's niece and the keeper of her legacy is the venerable Adelaide Cromwell Gulliver, Adelaide Cromwell Hill Gulliver, emeritus professor at Boston University, herself a former director of African American Studies, also keeper of the legacy of Dorothy West, many, many other accomplishments. A preliminary inquiry to Professor Gulliver that asked her and framed her Aunt Otelia, or she called her Aunt T, as a progenitor of African American studies, elicited a sharp contradiction. She would not have wanted to be known as someone doing African American studies. What she was doing was literature, said Professor Gulliver. So, too, John Hope Franklin's insistence, his ironic insistence that Negro history would be studied in history departments and that the University of Chicago would never have African American studies. John Hope Franklin is part of why the University of Chicago doesn't have African American studies. And we can read these stances as conservative or as a radical restructuring of what is relevant knowledge and what will be done under traditional departmental rubrics. Let us turn just briefly to another black woman scholar in 1931, one whom we usually consider as a writer. Of course, I'm speaking of Zora Neale Hurston. There's so many Hurstons, it is daunting to think about where to focus one's inquiry, of course. We know her best as the author of The Sumptuous Their Eyes Were Watching God, and perhaps also as the woman who marched through the very streets around us in her tilted chapeau, making declarations such as, "I am not tragically colored." But her career taken as a whole contains myriad facets and phrases, and I don't need to go through all of these for you all. She was strategic, she did as she pleases, and apparently modeled herself on herself. In 1931, Hurston had for some years been engaged in serious anthropological study under the guidance of Franz Boas with Melville Herskovitz and also Ruth Benedict. And that work with Ruth Benedict, they talk about her as a scholar, a student of Boas's and Herskovitz, but she also worked very intimately with Ruth Benedict. Her work took her deep into the intimacy of black communities in Honduras, Jamaica, Bermuda, Florida, New Orleans, and Haiti. She collected the folklore and ritual that she published in Mules and Men and Tell My Horse, demonstrating how deeply Hurston was taken into these communities to know their ways and philosophies. The measure of her work in that field, Hurston as anthropologist, not merely as colorful raconteur, has been well underway with other scholars. And I want us just to pause for a minute. I'm not going to talk about Hurston at length, but just to put her on the table, to think about the ways in which she affected the discipline itself. Picture Hurston as Langston Hughes describes her in The Big C, moving through Harlem with her calipers. Literally, picture her. Quote, "Almost nobody could stop the average Harlemite on Lenox Avenue and measure his head with a strange-looking anthropological device and not get bawled out for the attempt except Zora, who used to stop anyone whose head looked interesting and measure it." That's Hughes in The Big C. Her work articulated an intimate understanding of what we now call the black diaspora and African retention, black people occurring everywhere and in connection, Haiti, Jamaica, Florida, Harlem, USA. And I would argue that in her opening, and again I'm condensing this piece, of Mules and Men, where she talks about how she felt that, read you this little bit. "When I pitched head foremost into the world, I landed in the crib of Negroism. From the earliest rocking of my cradle, I had known about the capers Br'er Rabbit is apt to cut and what Squinch Owl says from the housetop, but it was fitting me like a tight chemise. I couldn't see it for wearing it. It was only when I was off in college, away from my native surroundings, that I could see myself like somebody else and stand off and look at my garment. Then I had to have the spyglass of anthropology to look through at that." And so I think what I want to just condense here is, if you think about this book and this introduction as being decades ahead of theorizing what it means to be of the community of people that you study, of studying communities of color from within, of putting the embodied subject as investigator into academic work, the embodied female subject, the embodied black subject, and for its techniques of storytelling, which become an intimate part of the weave of her scholarship. I think that you have a look ahead not only to some of the principles that we hold dear in African American studies, but also a very important early intervention into the discipline of anthropology when it is still a relatively young discipline in the United States. In 1931, another black woman was finishing her work for the master's degree in anthropology at Harvard. Like Hurston, she was interested in black people and their ways, in communities that were familiar to her, that she could move in and interpret in ways no white investigator could. I have long wondered if Hurston was acquainted with that woman, Caroline Bonday. In 1932, when Day graduated from Harvard, she became the first woman of any color to earn a master's degree in physical anthropology. At the time, to the best of my knowledge, there were only two other African-American women who were studying anthropology, Hurston, and, of course, Catherine Dunham, who was studying at Northwestern University in Chicago and published her work on Haiti and Jamaica and Journey to Acompong and Islands Possessed. Also, a little bit after that, later in the 1930s, a woman named Manet Helen Fowler, who I'm just starting to study, gets her degree in journalism with a minor in anthropology and accounting from NYU, and she goes on quite a bit later in 1952 to become the first woman of color to earn her PhD in anthropology, and that she earns that from Cornell. But the work commences in the 30s, just to give us a sense of that time. Caroline Bonday's thesis, A Study of Some Negro-White Families in the United States, was published in 1932 by the Harvard African Series. These three women had no predecessors in their field. In Day's archive at the Peabody Museum at Harvard, there is a newspaper clipping from 1926 that mentions the work of Miss Zora Neale Hurston doing anthropological study in Harlem with her professor Franz Boas. I don't know if any of us were in the newspaper when we were in graduate school, for being in graduate school, but she was at the time. My colleague Robert Steptoe has coined the wonderful and useful phrase, family bookshelf Afro-Americanist, to describe the way that most of us, certainly up to my generation, did the bulk of our learning in African-American literature at home or autodidactically or in black community context rather than at school. Though I had the defining good fortune of a good college education in Afro-American studies, nonetheless, the vast, vast majority of what I learned from the field began at home. And at home also, I learned that black life is ephemeral and precious, and learned powerfully that the archive was our responsibility and no one else's, that nobody would truly mind our legacy but ourselves. When I was a child, I loved looking at the books on my parents' shelves, and A Study of Some Negro-White Families was one that I returned to time and again. This book chronicled over 300 families of mixed black and white ancestry, sometimes using the sometimes discomforting methodologies of physical anthropology available at the time, the measurements of skull widths, nose breadths, hair texture, and so forth, along with sociological inquiry into subjects' home, work, and social habits. Who were these people sitting in photographs on porches with their high white collars and crocheted shawls, their voluminous hair arranged carefully, people named Archibald and Florida, Nancy and Josephine, Ulysses, Nellie, Sinai, Etna, Daisy, Augustus, and Inez? The book is a hefty tome, and within its pages of prose were the things that most compelled me, the photographs, most taken by Day herself, not only of her subjects, but also of their hair. Under each portrait and hair sample was a racial breakdown, fractions of N, Negro, W, White, I, Indian, in the subject's racial makeup. This information was ascertained through interviews and knowledge of family history, but the racial combinations marked the pictures of the hair samples so that, once again, discomfortingly, they became representative of racial types. Hair was described along a spectrum from frizzled to curly to deep waves to low waves to perfectly straight. Day wrote of the extreme mutability of black hair texture and emphasized, quote, it is doubtful if two people are ever seen with hair that is exactly alike. The book amazed me. It was unlike anything I had ever seen nor have seen since. It seemed to both expose the secret lives of black people and conceal further secrets behind its pages. There were notable names amongst the family trees, W.E.B. Du Bois, 5/8 N, 3/8 W, Josephine St. Pierre Ruffin, 3/8 N, 1/8 I, 4/8 W. Artist Laura Wheeler Waring, 4/8 N, 1/8 I, 3/8 W. Civic leader Walter White, you want to know? 5/32 N, 1/32 I, 26/32 W, and so forth. It seemed an invitation to self-anatomy and analysis. It seemed somehow embarrassing, black intimacy on display and open to imperfect interpretation. I loved the structures of proper family trees, the lines and branches that connected. I would ruminate on the stopping point, the ancestor beyond which we could not go, where the information stopped. Often, of course, it stopped where the slave ships let off on the shores of the United States. Day's charts stopped with pure racial types, the full-blood African or Indian or Caucasian. Who was always a man? I cut a snippet from my own hair as a child and tried to hold it next to the samples. Did my hair reflect my blood? What was Day trying to demonstrate with the study? First, it's important to think about race mixture as it was imagined in the 1920s. She was thinking about black people whose ancestors were African and Caucasian and often Native American. In other words, she was talking about black folks when she says Negro white. Her working papers were kept because her professor, Ernest Houghton, put them in the Peabody, and they're the only extant working notes of a project taken on by a black woman in those years in that place, a place which, of course, is also the land of Agassiz, and that's a whole other thing that we could go on about, but to think about what she was thinking about, how she was intervening with the legacy of Agassiz, which Boas and others had certainly begun to take on, but which loomed enormously over this kind of science. The archive contains the cards on which Day kept notes and measurements on the physiognomy of her 2,537 subjects. There are large, careful charts and family trees, and perhaps most fascinating is her correspondence with her subjects. In these letters, we see her energy and tenacity. She pursued the project over a decade through serious illness, other jobs, and geographic dispersal. We see the extent of her social network. Her subjects were often people she knew, so letters not only address the business at hand, but also the affairs of the day. She consults, quote, older people in the community who were not related, but whose unofficial business it was seemingly to remember the ancestry of everybody else. And her own powers of persuasion are evident, not least of all when the thorny issue of passing arose. Bond's work seems to have been supported in its initial stages by her communities, perhaps because her subjects were proud to support the work of one of their women endorsed by a grant at Harvard University in the 1920s, work that she consistently and proudly described as, quote, research in the field of anthropology. But when she wrote people again to ask permission to publish her findings, objections frequently arose, quote, we do not wish publication. None of us want either information or pictures used in book form. People ask her to be discreet about matters such as income. And one says, my brother is strictly W- in Boston. You understand. Other subjects were described as fearful of exposure because they were, quote, passing for white or had, quote, gone to the other side. It's actually a whole encyclopedia of fabulous passing euphemisms, crossed over, you know, so forth. And Day stated that of 346 families, 35 of the families state that there are one or more members who are passing, either entirely or only temporarily for purposes of obtaining lucrative employment. She says that she knows of 50 more families with members passing who were not part of her study and wrote, quote, practically every family with whom I have talked can give me an additional few names. She's careful to talk about her attempts to make a cross-section class-wise of black communities and is explicit that she did not want the achievements of some members of her group, quote, to argue for the advantage of race crossing. It is my firm belief that Negroes who are of unmixed blood are just as capable of achievement along all lines as those who are mixed. It sounds awkward but belies a firm understanding of the danger of the work she was doing and the danger of any reading of the body and what can be done with that information. Some of her older subjects, as she said, quote, were children of the very masters with whom they served. In 1927, she writes that she's giving up using blood samples. Quote, I decided that if I could not get them from whole families, they were not worth very much. She developed her own methodological quirks, which illustrate the ways in which her inquiry could only have been conducted from within the group being studied. With regard to hair samples, for example, Day notes that, quote, errors due to artificial straightening were partly eliminated by Mrs. Day, who knew most of the subjects and had notes on their true hair form. Amongst her papers are letters from Du Bois. On April 25, 1930, he wrote this short genealogical sketch. My maternal great-great-grandfather was a soldier in the Revolutionary War, and my maternal great-grandfather was in Shays' Rebellion. Several members of this family were in the Civil War, one being a corporal. On my father's side, my grandfather was of the white Du Bois family of Ulster County, New York, and my grandfather, being white enough to pass, was educated at the well-known Cheshire School in Connecticut until his father died and he was apprenticed. One member of my paternal grandfather's family was United Minister to Haiti. My grandfather is buried on the Yale campus next to the grave of Yehudi Ashman. In this unguarded letter, we see his assiduous attempts to write himself a proxy for the Negro writ large, into various narratives of belonging, educationally, militarily, nationally, religiously, racially. Many of her correspondents similarly chronicle that which some must have believed would have been lost to history otherwise. One of the boxes of Day's archive is a bibliography of an early course in African-American anthropology. There are several clippings from miscellaneous newspapers and journals with titles such as, "Anthropologists say there is no such thing as absolutely pure race. Anthropologists say Nordic superiority is a myth." Quote, that's from the National News of the Elks. Quote, "The African pygmy and the blonde Nordic belong to one species." The work of a Dr. Faye Cooper Cole at the University of Chicago is said to have done that study. There's Carter G. Woodson's Free Negro Heads of Families in the United States in 1830, together with a brief treatment of the free Negro. There's a book by Wendell Dabney of Cincinnati's Colored Citizens, an article by Ralph Bunch, quote, "The Negro in Chicago Politics." An article by her advisor, Ernest Hooton, quote, "The Evolution of the Human Face and Its Relation to Head Form," read before the Easter Association of Graduates of the Angle School of Orthodontia in Boston, Massachusetts, reprinted from the journal The Dental Cosmos. And there's the 1902 Atlanta University study, The College Bred Negro. I read out this eclectic archive because I think it reveals the working process of building bibliography in a new discipline, where the card catalog does not give you what you want and where today Google Scholar will not give you what you want. It is this piecing together and pulling from disparity that characterizes the work of African Americanists to this day. Why the discipline of anthropology? What did the metaphorical tea leaves of physiognomy suggest today? In the end, for me, the Caroline Bonday Project is about a black woman trying to move beyond received ideas about race, to do more than follow hunches, but let a relatively new science tell her things she did not already know or perhaps even suspect. That she pushed her social group, many of whom did not want to be pushed or investigated, to tell their stories and secrets. That she made black people believe that having their bodies calibrated and measured, their very body hair snipped and analyzed and saved, would tell them something they did not know. That seems audacious, bodacious, perhaps visionary, especially when we look at the state of art and science involved with the boom in DNA ancestry and research today. It is though she imagined the disarticulated black body could be put back together again in a new light and drawing new conclusions, the full span of Negro endowment and achievement. So too Hurston with her calipers in Harlem. Day's anthropology would not hold up against what we now know about race and biology. She also mixed what we would call sociology with hard science, imagining certain traits as representative. But I think this illustrates the way in which early African American studies was interdisciplinary out of necessity. When you consider the small number of highly educated black people engaging in serious study of black people, they so avidly gleaned whatever they could from whatever disciplinary exposure they might have had. Higher education was that dear and that rare. So small wonder that a trained anthropologist would employ sociological techniques and would then settle in and work from an English department, as Day did. She did a lot of this work from the English department at Atlanta University. And she wrote fiction, such as her much anthologized story, The Pink Hat. It didn't mean that she was scattershot across the disciplines, but rather that she was an economical intellectual who used every scrap she had been exposed to in the service of educating her people and theorizing on their lives and conditions, and so too Hurston, with her extraordinary gifts of metaphor and ear for textured language, created her own form in Mules and Men, a form with which to write with an insider's knowledge but an outsider's keen eye. How do we commune with the illustrious Negro dead? A phrase I will explicate shortly. How is that part of the work of doing African American studies? And here, moving toward conclusion, I will briefly turn to the autobiographical, something with which African American and feminist studies of the last 50 years have shown us is admissible in our scholarly work. We had that strange book in my house growing up because Caroline Day was my great aunt. And if that had not been the case, I'm quite certain I wouldn't have known about her work, though anthropologists have more recently become aware of her in about the last 10 years, and scholars such as Heidi Artizone have begun to write about it. In studying Great Aunt Carrie, who lived in family lore but was unknown to me, died long before I was born, so she then became another elusive scholarly subject, I went to the Peabody Museum at Harvard. The archive is where I commune with the illustrious Negro dead. On my first visit, I was overwhelmed by all that was there, but particularly wanted to see if they had the hair samples that she worked with. And amazingly, there, folded four times into pieces of white paper, is the hair, hundreds of cuttings from people in her study, cuttings she photographed and then put on pages indicating racial mixture, hair of differing degrees of length, bend, curl, frizzle, shine. hair like smoke, hair marked three-quarters I, one-quarter I, one-quarter N, boxes full of nearly 100-year-old black hair. Properly, the archivist told me this should not even be here. Organic material must be kept elsewhere. So needless to say, she said, you're not to touch the hair, you're not to look at the whole lot of it. But I had to see the hair of one of Caroline Bondé's subject in particular, her half-sister, Winona Bond, 19 years old in 1927 when the sample was clipped, my grandmother. The archivist complied. What can I say about sitting in an archive at Harvard University holding a piece of my grandmother's hair? When she died at 86, the last thing I did in her presence, in the presence of her body, was stroke her beautiful hair, which felt wavy and soft as it always had and slightly crisped with hairspray, though she had been dead for an hour. Her spirit was still in the room but was quickly leaving, and we could feel it, and that was that. The hair was the last of her I touched before she died. Her hair now in the archive before me, the same color as mine at 19, dark brown with a slightly reddish undertone, not as curly as mine, a bit mussy as befits a young woman on the go, as she was then, away from Washington, D.C., from inevitable teacher's college and early imminent marriage, from the further south of most of the people she knew and came from, toward learning and sister and all the possibilities she enacted and represented, this black woman in the midst of few others, making herself up and making up with a few others a discipline. I touched the hair, though I was not supposed to. I am reverent about libraries and archives and their rules, so I justified my transgression with the thought that I was the only person on planet Earth who might ever need to touch this particular hank of hair. I held my grandmother's hair, which felt like the end of her, except stranger still, it was the before of her, before I knew her, before she even had a child who would be my mother. This was a Winona Bond I never knew, nor did my mother. No, not Winona, a hank of her hair at 19. According to her sister's notations, one half N, one quarter I, one quarter W. What does it, what could it possibly tell me? Taking care not to disturb its pattern, I put the cutting back into the paper and folded the packet four times and returned it to the archivist, who put it in a glassine envelope in an acid-free box in a basement at the Peabody Museum at Harvard University, where it remains in the Caroline Bondé papers. And then I wrote about it, first in something more belletristic and now in this broader study. The artistic impulse is sometimes the most powerful way that African-American experience can be understood. And so, to really conclude, I want to turn to a letter that Zora Neale Hurston wrote to W.E.B. Du Bois that I've been thinking about for some years now. And I finally realized the ways in which it offers an object lesson and some metaphors to explain this idea of the prehistory of the discipline of African American studies. Hurston did not always get on with so-called Negro establishment figures. Her vitality and forthrightness was sometimes taken as irreverent and unbecoming the race. She had a keen pretension meter and at one point called Du Bois, quote, a goateed, egotistic, wishy-washy, haughty aristocrat. And she called Mary McLeod Bethune a heifer. which would be my favorite line in the paper. But that didn't stop her from writing to Du Bois in 1945, and she wrote, you know how you say, you know, Paris, France, you write where you're writing from. And Hurston wrote in the top corner, from aboard the houseboat cruiser Suntan. She wrote with a wild and wonderful idea, quote, as Dean of American Negro Artists, why do you not propose a cemetery for the illustrious Negro dead? Something like Père Lachaise in Paris. She envisions it on lush Florida terrain and suggests that, quote, Negro sculptors and painters decorate it with scenes from our own literature and life, mythology and all. She suggests, quote, there's a one and then two, that there be no regular chapel unless a tremendous amount of money be secured. Let there be a hall of meeting and let the